Majority, your host Darren Kaster, is here. I've got Kevin Farmer in the studio with me today. All day, we're going to be chatting out about a bunch of fun news. The theme of the show today is more or less the danger of science denial. It also happens to be the name of a TED Talks by Michael Spector that we'll be playing. And we've got a pretty big news roundup. There's a lot of stuff going on, and just generally with a theme of science today. I know that's such a shock because we never ever talk about science on this program, but the theme specifically of the danger of denial of science. So we're going to talk about Michael Spector's piece. We're going to play the piece. Interestingly enough, I violently disagree with him on a couple of issues, but so we're going to find out exactly what those are later on, even because I violently agree with him on a few others, so it should be interesting. I know Kevin will probably have similar opinions to mine, but we'll see exactly what he's got to say a little bit later in the program. We're also going to be playing another piece of the Story of Stuff project, which is put on largely by Annie Leonard, co-director of the Story of Stuff project. This week, we're going to be playing the story of cosmetics, and also just a second, we're going to be playing a clip from President Obama's inauguration speech. It's about a minute long, where he talks about the environment, and my initial thing I'm going to warn you is that I found this to be highly suspect, but we're going to listen to that first. First off, before we get to that, though, I want to welcome Kevin to the show. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Darren.
So we'll jump right into that, though. There's a lot of news, as I said, I want to get to, but I think one of the bigger pieces of news was the second term inauguration for U.S. President Obama, who did address the environment pretty head-on in his inauguration speech. I've sort of already formed an opinion about it. I don't know, Kevin, if you even had a chance to hear it yet, but we're going to play it now, and then we'll come back. It's about a minute long, and then we're gonna comment on the content.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult. But America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it. We cannot cede to other nations the technology that will power new jobs and new industries. We must claim its promise. That's how we will maintain our economic vitality and our national treasure. Our forests and waterways, our croplands and snow-capped peaks. That is how we will preserve our planet, commanded to our care by God. That's what will lend meaning to the creed our fathers once declared.
All right, so there you have it. That was about a minute's worth of the quite a bit longer 2013 second term inauguration speech by President Barack Obama. Kevin Farmer, your thoughts before I jump in with my sarcasm.
Well, we're going to be playing role reverse.
Go on.
Because it gave me chills listening to that. He's hit the nail squarely on the head that there is a societal transformation needs to take place, and he's first of all, it's an imperative. The planet can't survive runaway climate change. It might not even survive a small climate change. Civilization might not survive when the destruction of croplands and the loss of fresh water supplies. Like these could be, you know, hugely destabilizing events, even on what you might call sort of a globally minor scale. I would say only a few billion people are losing their access to water through melting glaciers and the drought lands over breadbaskets and you know, the inability to produce sufficient food to feed the masses. So, you know, call that kind of a globally minor change. We might not, you know, even that could be, you know, geopolitically destabilizing and have a crippling effect on world economies and whatnot. But, you know, more importantly, we might not survive. The planet could, there's a potential the planet could not survive climate change. So a shift has to take place, and it has to be, and I mean, our reliance on fossil fuel just cannot be overstated. It's an input into almost every manufacturing stream and every product life cycle. It's the cheap energy that has fueled the transition to wealth that the OECD nations have enjoyed, because of all this, you know, free energy that's just been lying around in the ground that's powered you know, what we'd like to, like, what we treasure is the advancements of civilization. So a shift has to take place, and he's right. It has to take place, and he's also right that, you know, if you want, if you, you want to be on the winning side of history on this one, you want to be the one developing the technologies, and you want to be the one developing the expertise that's going to be required. And he's talking about it to revitalize the economy, to make sure that to ensure the security of their economy, but also he makes the point of preserving the planet. He's not blind to the larger issues, and he campaigned on this, and he won the election. He campaigned talking climate change. He's been talking climate change ever since. He made it part of his inauguration. It's rumored to figure large into his address to the Union. And I just think he hit all the right notes, and I think you know, he's got 2 years now before he becomes a lame duck president, in which to, and I think he has political capital, and I'm just dying to see what he does with this opportunity.
All right, so now time for my sarcasm. I agree with you on absolutely everything, except for the fact that I think he's just full of it. That's all. I don't buy his commitment for a second. I think it was a very well written speech because he knows what his voters want to hear. I don't think he shares the conviction that that speech implies. And I think that that's not based on pure cynicism. I think that's based on his track record. I mean, he ran on a whole bunch of stuff the first time around. First and foremost was that, you know, just the easy target there is immediately shutting down Guantanamo Bay, which never happened.
Yeah.
I mean, really, like, the Young Turks, I don't know if I believe that a lot of their research was passed on from other sort of liberally minded things. So if you want to take that as a biased point of view, you know, go ahead. But I mean, there's all sorts of other issues where you can draw a line pretty much down. If you stack up most presidents, every president on most issues, if you kind of compare the claims that they made to what actually happened to their donors, the donors and the claims they made don't match up. The donors and what actually happened does. And in this case, I've heard the example given that people, he was fighting popular opinion on things like gay marriage. He's come out now and made some very strong statements, the progressive. Yeah, but it turns out that actually a lot of his major donors are actually super... are very, very interested in having marriage equality. So that's not a, you know, him responding being populist issue. That's a, you know, his people who give him money and got him elected wanted something, so he's doing it. And I just think the oil companies have more money. I think so far as I've been disappointed by really exciting soundy speeches by him before, and the result seems to be dictated by who's paying him.
Well, okay. So it's true that American politics has to a large extent been co-opted by big money. And it's also true that he didn't live up to the promises of his first term, although I would point out that he was largely hamstrung by a recalcitrant Congress, which was controlled by Republicans who were bent on obfuscating any legislative initiative he took. It just mindlessly partisan politics was taking place. If Obama wanted to do it, they were opposed to it, regardless of its merits. But I've also read that it is his donors who are pushing him to address climate change, that he does have the backing of groups and donors that are concerned about climate change, and this is part of the pressure for him to address climate change. And I don't think he can back down from these statements very easily. I just don't think he would, you know, there's still wiggle room on climate change politically, you know, mm-hmm. especially in the States where the population is very split. It's not such an obviously popular issue that I think there's still enough risks politically in championing it that I don't think he would champion it lightly. I think he's serious about this. We'll have to wait and see. But if he is serious, this is the best news we've had in decades. If the president of the United States is serious about a societal transformation in the face of climate change, this is almost, you know, the next best thing is a green China.
Yeah. Well, and we have some Chinese news coming up. We're going to break for a brief music break here before we come back and talk a little bit more about the danger of science denial. Just to leave it there, I'll sneak in my last comment, being that, yeah, I mean, I totally think that he will do something about these issues. I don't think that it's totally talking out of one side of his mouth and acting out of the other. I just think that the absolute hammer from the sky that that statement sounded like is going to turn out to be a toothpick. That's all. I think he's talking a really good game. I loved the speech as a speech. I just don't think that the strength and power and conviction of that speech is going to translate into strength and power and conviction as a president on action. I just don't see it. But we'll find out. We'll find out. I guess it depends, if we're going to take my cynical view on who has more money, the oil companies or Al Gore. But well, anyway, we're going to break for a quick music break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is the Green Majority on CIUT.
Down to the river, flowing out onto the sea. On my way to the ocean, let the spirit swallow me. I got low down in the water, I let the current guide my bones. I got nine kinds of trouble, I'm just trying to find my way home. Twenty-some years of living and 1,000 wasted days. I have loved a lot of women, many times I've gone wrong ways. And I came down to the water for a dip to cleanse my soul. They keep telling me that I'm just a babe, but baby, why do I feel so old? Fine line that cannot be bent, and I felt like a river run dry, but I don't know where all of the rainwater went. And I believe we were all dead or dying, but I see different in the blue light. There is no such thing as a dawn or a dusk. It's daylight until it is night. You gotta fight through the demon. You gotta run into the west. You gotta
All right, you are listening to The Green Majority. I'm your host, Aaron Kaster, and this is CIUT 89.5 in Toronto, or this could potentially be one of our amazing and beautiful syndicates across the country. Today, we're talking largely about science. We started talking about Barack Obama's speech, which was dealing a lot with... one of the things I did notice there that was that he did, in addition to saying, we need alternative energy and everything, was that he sort of made a very calculated, but I think stronger than I'm used to hearing from him, jab at people who are denying science. Like he specifically said, he basically said in the speech, your personal opinions don't matter, the science, you're just wrong. Like, and I thought that particularly impressed me, that particular language. I do have to sort of back off on it on one point, that... If he was completely full of it, I don't think he would have made that part of it that strong, because he definitely didn't leave any wiggle room for anyone who was denying it. So I think that was really strong. But unfortunately, Europe as well has not been learning from their environmental disasters. This was referring to an article from The Guardian talking about an 800-page report by the European Environment Agency that basically found out that thousands, literally thousands of lives could have been saved and millions or perhaps billions of euros worth of damage, both to ecosystems and to infrastructure, could have been avoided if the precautionary principle had been applied on the basis of early warning. So what they're basically saying, the review was called just released 2013, and it's called Late Lessons from Early Warnings. And it was published just a couple of days ago, actually. Kevin, I know you had a look at this. It goes through a whole bunch of issues here. But, I mean, this is sort of basically a summation. They could have really just checked our website if they wanted to do this research. but some particularly startling details. They found A lot of very specific, so not just kind of generalized claims of tampering, but I mean specific evidence that companies involved in things had created manufacturing doubt, had disregarded scientific evidence, had deliberately devised strategies with think tanks and industry groups on strategies to disseminate false or misleading information to delay legislation, prevent regulation, all sorts of things. The market has just gone mad, taken over. What was your opinion on reading after reading this article?
Well, so the article stresses the precautionary principle, which is one of the fundamental tenets of environmentalism and conservationism. And, you know, I like to point out things like, how much does cancer cost our medical system? How much does it really cost us to treat cancer patients? The cancer rates in Canada right now are almost 1 in 3 if you're a woman, and better than 1 in 2 if you're a man. And that's an epidemic. If that many people were being kidnapped, we'd be convening, you know, royal commissions, and you would see, you know, massive large scale action. These are numbers that are just hard to imagine. And it means out of the two of us, you know, one of us sitting here in this room, one of us has, the odds are one of us is going to develop cancer in the course of their life. And I don't want to develop cancer, and I don't want better treatments for cancer. I don't want better surgeries. I just don't want to get it in the first place. And what we've done is we've allowed the business model to prevail, and companies produce chemicals by the thousands every year. New chemicals are flooded and bathed in chemicals, and the burden of proof is on society to be a laboratory that says, okay, we're going to unleash, you know, Teflon because eggs won't stick to your pan anymore, and we're going to wait 20 years to see what happens to the cancer rate. And we're going to see if it's an environmentally persistent toxin or not. Does it degrade? Does it build up in the fat cells? Does it cause cancer? Does it cause other, you know, any form of endocrine disruption? And then, you know, business employs the strategy of the paid skeptic when finally we do sort of start to identify these toxins or factors or inputs, whatever you want to call them.
Well, it came up a lot during the interview with Adria Vassal about all these sorts of things that are in products. We don't know very, very well outlined in the piece. Hopefully we'll have time for it to play later, which was the story of cosmetics, which is something that just comes up time and time and time again on this program, which is that people sort of have an assumption that, you know, the government regulates stuff. I buy stuff, therefore the stuff that I buy has been regulated by government. And there's two major problems with that. First of all is that that's not true. The second of all is even that the stuff that is regulated has been heavily influenced by lobbyists. So there's a bunch of stuff that nobody's ever done any health checks on at all. Tons and tons of stuff in cosmetics, body care products, food, all sorts of things that have never been had any research done at all, except for that, hey, 20 years later, it turns out, you know, 8 out of 10 of these people that ate XYZ or put on, you know, XYZ brand lipstick, turns out they all have, you know, their children are having extra limbs or birth defects or higher precedence of cancer or anything it might be. And they go, oops. And then the research happens to go find out, oh, right, okay. So it turns out that XYZ is a endocrine disruptor or a carcinogen or whatever are bad. Let's switch to something else that we haven't tested and find out 20 years after that what happened to that. Like, it's just this ridiculous cycle. And the main problem is that people think that this stuff is checked, and a huge amount of it isn't. It's just not checked.
You're absolutely right. Industry releases tens of thousands of new chemicals every year. There's just a flood. We are literally being bathed in chemicals. And what you just described shows, you know, some company spends 20 years producing a product, makes their money, and then leaves society with a cancer bill. And deaths, you know, unnecessary, totally preventable, unnecessary deaths, and the tragedy that goes along with that. And this is what the precautionary principle talks about. There's no need for the pace of what we like to call progress to move at such a blinding speed. There's just the burden of proof should be on industry to show that their chemicals are safe, but we don't apply that principle even remotely to anything. The businesses, industry is allowed pretty much free rein, and then you know, we get what's happened in Canada sort of 20, 30 years later. We get a list of banned chemicals, but what's been the proof of those banned chemicals is that they finally, someone, you know, painstaking research has finally linked them causally to cancer, which is not an easy thing to do. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of people to die from it and suffer, and even the survivors suffer with missing, you know, with surgeries and chemotherapy and just the other interventions for cancer. You know, like the article specifically refers to Europe. Like, look at the heat wave in France that killed something like 30,000 people, and you would think that alone would be, you know, okay, let's stop messing with the climate. We don't want to. How many heat waves can we survive?
And the solution is clearly better air conditioning.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get better air conditioning so we can put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And the article also mentions Fukushima, and Britain is building nuclear reactors on low-lying grounds that are likely to get flooded with rising seas. It's astonishing how little wisdom, you know, when you think of the precautionary principle, and you look at, you know, sort of the lives that could be saved and the unimaginable amounts of money that could have been saved, and you wonder why we're not applying the precautionary principle as a rule of thumb to industry and the business model. It just makes no sense.
Well, we better get moving with some of the content here. I want to make sure we get to the features here, so because I want to get back and bring that into the conversation. My last comment, just because you brought me to this, and I love it. I hope we have a couple economics students out there somewhere. But if you've ever looked at things about, like, you know, arguments against dealing with climate change, there's something called discounting. If you did discounting of future products, and I won't get into an economics lesson. If it's going over your head, maybe just look it up or something. But basically, what happens is the farther in the future you project something, the cheaper it is. So if I buy a pencil today, it will be even cheaper to buy a pencil 10 years from now. So I can't value that pencil as much if I'm talking about it in the future.
Right.
In theory, it makes sense. But what happens is they do things like, oh, well, to cure climate change, it's going to cost us $100 trillion, but it will only be $10 trillion in the future.
Right.
So we'll just wait till later to deal with that. That's essentially how the argument works. Now, it sounds insane, I know, but there's a lot of people that seriously think that this is how it works. Here's what they don't factor in, or here's one of the many problems I have with that entire idea of discounting when you're dealing with things like climate change or major global level environmental issues, is you haven't taken into effect that amount of money is required for, it needs to have an economy to generate it, right? If in that 40 years that you've discounted stuff, you've wiped out half those people because of heat waves, there's no economy to generate that money. So it might actually be like $100 trillion today, but there's 6.5 billion people here contributing to an economy. If we don't have half those people, then maybe it is actually in relative terms, as far as like the cost per person, higher, even if it's a tenth of the cost later in the future. Now, maybe that's a little bit over maybe I bit off more than I could chew before getting into that, but it's just talking about like all the assumptions that goes into the actual, there are actual arguments for accepting the science but not sort of following what you and I sort of think we should do. But there are also really, really good counterarguments, because a lot of them are really dumb. Anyway, that's my opinion. We're going to go. This is Michael Spector, though. Michael Spector is brought to us today courtesy by TED Talks. He's a writer for The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and The New York Times, among other things. Very, very good speaker. Let's see if you can spot the thing that I really, really disagree with him about, though. But we're going to go to the feature, and we'll be right back and talk about it.
Pretend right here we have a machine, a big machine, a cool TED-ish machine, and it's a time machine. And everyone in this room has to get into it. And you can go backwards, you can go forwards, you cannot stay where you are. And I wonder what you'd choose, because I've been asking my friends this question a lot lately, and they all want to go back. I don't know, they want to go back before there were automobiles or Twitter or American Idol. I don't know. I'm convinced that there's some sort of pull to nostalgia, to wishful thinking, and I understand that. I'm not part of that crowd, I have to say. I don't want to go back, and it's not because I'm adventurous. It's because possibilities on this planet, they don't go back, they go forward. So I want to get in the machine, and I want to go forward. This is the greatest time there's ever been on this planet. By any measure that you wish to choose, health, wealth, mobility, opportunity, declining rates of disease, there's never been a time like this. My great-grandparents died, all of them, by the time they were 60. My grandparents pushed that number to 70. My parents are closing in on 80. So there better be a 9 in the beginning of my death number. But it's not even about people like us, because this is a bigger deal than that. A kid born in New Delhi today can expect to live as long as the richest man in the world did 100 years ago. I mean, think about that. It's an incredible fact. And why is it true? Smallpox. Smallpox killed billions of people on this planet. It reshaped the demography of the globe in a way that no war ever has. It's gone. It's vanished. We vanquished it. Poof. In the rich world, diseases that threatened millions of us just a generation ago no longer exist, hardly. Diphtheria, rubella, polio, does anyone even know what those things are? Vaccines, modern medicine, our ability to feed billions of people, those are triumphs of the scientific method. And to my mind, the scientific method, trying stuff out, seeing if it works, changing it when it doesn't, is one of the great accomplishments of humanity. So that's the good news. Unfortunately, that's all the good news. Because there are some other problems, and they've been mentioned many times, and one of them is that despite all our accomplishments, a billion people go to bed hungry in this world every day. That number's rising, and it's rising really rapidly, and it's disgraceful. And not only that, we've used our imagination to thoroughly trash this globe. Potable water, arable land, rainforests, oil, gas, they're going away, and they're going away soon. And unless we innovate our way out of this mess, we're going away too. So the question is, can we do that? And I think we can. I think it's clear that we can make food that will feed billions of people without raping the land that they live on. I think we can power this world with energy that doesn't also destroy it. I really do believe that, and no, it ain't wishful thinking. But here's the thing that keeps me up at night, one of the things that keeps me up at night. We've never needed progress in science more than we need it right now, never. And we've also never been in a position to deploy it properly in the way that we can today. We're on the verge of amazing, amazing events in many fields. And yet, I actually think we'd have to go back hundreds, 300 years before the Enlightenment to find a time when we battled progress, when we fought about these things more vigorously on more fronts than we do now. People wrap themselves in their beliefs, and they do it so tightly that you can't set them free. Not even the truth will set them free. And listen, everyone's entitled to their opinion. They're even entitled to their opinion about progress. But you know what you're not entitled to? You're not entitled to your own facts. Sorry, you're not. And this took me a while to figure out. About a decade ago, I wrote a story about vaccines for The New Yorker, a little story, and I was amazed to find opposition. Opposition to what is, after all, the most effective public health measure in human history. I didn't know what to do, so I just did what I do. I wrote a story and I moved on. And soon after that, I wrote a story about genetically engineered food. Same thing, only bigger. People were going crazy. So I wrote a story about that too, and I couldn't understand why people thought this was Frankenfoods, why they thought moving molecules around in a specific rather than a haphazard way was trespassing on nature's ground. But, you know, I do what I do. I wrote this story, I moved on. I mean, I'm a journalist. We type, we file, we go to dinner. It's fine. But these stories bothered me, and I couldn't figure out why, and eventually I did. And that's because those fanatics that were driving me crazy weren't actually fanatics at all. They were thoughtful people, educated people, decent people. They were exactly like the people in this room. And it just disturbed me so much, but then I thought, you know, let's be honest. We're at a point in this world where we don't have the same relationship to progress that we used to. We talk about it ambivalently. We talk about it in ironic terms with little quotes around it. Progress. Okay, there are reasons for that, and I think we know what those reasons are. We've lost faith in institutions, in authority, and sometimes in science itself. And there's no reason we shouldn't have. You can just say a few names, and people will understand. Chernobyl, Bhopal, the Challenger, Vioxx, weapons of mass destruction, hanging chads. I mean, you know, you can choose your list. There are questions and problems with the people we used to believe were always right. So be skeptical. Ask questions. Demand proof. Demand evidence. Don't take anything for granted. But here's the thing. When you get proof, you need to accept the proof. And we're not that good at doing that. And the reason that I can say that is because we're now in an epidemic of fear like one that I've never seen and hope never to see again. About 12 years ago, there was a story published, a horrible story, that linked the epidemic of autism to the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine shot. Very scary. Tons of studies were done to see if this was true. Tons of studies should have been done. It's a serious issue. The data came back. The data came back from the United States, from England, from Sweden, from Canada, and it was all the same. No correlation, no connection, none at all. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because we believe anecdotes. We believe what we see, what we think we see, what makes us feel real. We don't believe a bunch of documents from a government official giving us data. And I do understand that. I think we all do. But you know what? The result of that has been disastrous. Disastrous. Because here's a fact. The United States is one of the only countries in the world where the vaccine rate for measles is going down. That is disgraceful, and we should be ashamed of ourselves. It's horrible. And what kind of a thing happened that we could do that? Now, I understand it. I do understand it. Because anyone have measles here? Does one person in this audience ever see someone die of measles? Doesn't happen very much. Doesn't happen in this country at all, but it happened 160,000 times in the world last year. That's a lot of death of measles, 20 an hour. But since it didn't happen here, we can put it out of our minds. And people like Jenny McCarthy can go around preaching messages of fear and illiteracy from platforms like Oprah and Larry King Live. And they can do it because they don't link causation and correlation. They don't understand that these things seem the same, but they're almost never the same. And it's something we need to learn, and we need to learn it really soon. This guy was a hero, Jonas Salk. He took one of the worst scourges of mankind away from us. No fear, no agony, polio, poof, gone. That guy in the middle, not so much. His name is Paul Offit. He just developed a rotavirus vaccine with a bunch of other people. It'll save the lives of 400, 500,000 kids in the developing world every year. Pretty good, right? Well, it's good, except that Paul goes around talking about vaccines and says how valuable they are, and that people ought to just stop the whining. And he actually says it that way. So Paul's a terrorist. When Paul speaks in a public hearing, he can't testify without armed guards. He gets called at home because people like to tell him that they remember where his kids go to school. And why? Because Paul made a vaccine. I don't need to say this, but vaccines are essential. You take them away, disease comes back, horrible diseases. And that's happening. We have measles in this country now, and it's getting worse, and pretty soon kids are going to die again, because it's just a numbers game. And they're not just going to die of measles. What about polio? Let's have that. Why not? A college classmate of mine wrote me a couple weeks ago and said, you know, she thought it was a little strident. No one's ever said that before. She wasn't going to vaccinate her kid against polio. No way. Fine. Why? Because we don't have polio. And you know what? We didn't have polio in this country yesterday. Today, I don't know, maybe a guy got on a plane in Lagos this morning and he's flying to LAX right now. He's over Ohio. And he's going to land in a couple hours. He's going to rent a car and he's going to come to Long Beach. And he's going to attend one of these fabulous TED dinners tonight. And he doesn't know that he's infected with a paralytic disease, and we don't either. Because that's the way the world works. That's the planet we live on. Don't pretend it isn't. Now, we love to wrap ourselves in lies. We love to do it. Everyone take their vitamins this morning? Echinacea, a little antioxidant to get you going? I know you did, because half of Americans do every day. They take this stuff and they take alternative medicines, and it doesn't matter how often we find out that they're useless. The data says it all the time. They darken your urine. They almost never do more than that. It's okay. You want to pay $28 billion for dark urine? I'm totally with you. Dark urine. Dark. Why do we do that? Why do we do that? Well, I think I understand. We hate big pharma. We hate big government. We don't trust the man. And we shouldn't. Our healthcare system sucks. It's cruel to millions of people. It's absolutely astonishingly cold and soul deadening to those of us who can even afford it. So we run away from it, and where do we run? We leap into the arms of Big Placebo. That's fantastic. I love Big Placebo. Yeah. But you know, it's really a serious thing, because this stuff is crap, and we spend billions of dollars on it, and I have all sorts of little props here. None of it. Ginkgo, fraud. Echinacea, fraud. Acai, I don't even know what that is, but we're spending billions of dollars on it. It's fraud. And you know what? When I say this stuff, people scream at me and they say, what do you care? Let people do what they want to do. It makes them feel good. And you know what? You're wrong. Because I don't care if it's the Secretary of HHS who's saying, I'm not going to take the evidence of my experts on mammograms, or some cancer quack who wants to treat his patient with coffee enemas. When you start down the road where belief in magic replace evidence and science, you end up in a place you don't want to be. You end up in Thabo Mbeki's South Africa. He killed 400,000 of his people by insisting that beetroot, garlic, and lemon oil were much more effective than the antiretroviral drugs we know can slow the course of AIDS. Hundreds of thousands of needless deaths in a country that has been plagued worse than any other by this disease. Please, don't tell me there are no consequences to these things. There are. There always are. Now, the most mindless epidemic we're in the middle of right now is this absurd battle between proponents of genetically engineered food and the organic elite. It's an idiotic debate. It has to stop. It's a debate about words, about metaphors. It's ideology. It's not science. Every single thing we eat, every grain of rice, every sprig of parsley, every Brussels sprout has been modified by man. You know, there weren't tangerines in the Garden of Eden. There wasn't any cantaloupe. There weren't Christmas trees. We made it all. We made it over the last 11,000 years. And some of it worked and some of it didn't. We got rid of the stuff that didn't. Now we can do it in a more precise way. And there are risks. Absolutely. But we can put something like vitamin A into rice. And that stuff can help millions of people. Millions of people. Prolong their lives. You don't want to do that? I have to say, I don't understand it. We object to genetically engineered food. Why do we do that? Well, the things I constantly hear are too many chemicals, pesticides, hormones, monoculture. We don't want giant fields of the same thing. It's wrong. We don't want companies patenting life. We don't want companies owning seeds. And you know what my response to all of that is? Yes, you're right. Let's fix it. It's true. We've got a huge food problem, but this isn't science. This has nothing to do with science. It's law, it's morality, it's patent stuff. You know, science isn't a company. It's not a country. It's not even an idea. It's a process. It's a process. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But the idea that we should not allow science to do its job.
All right. Yeah, we're just going to fade that out. I'm sorry, folks, we're having a little bit of audio trouble there. I was going to stick with it, but I kept cutting out. So I do apologize. But I think we got to the meat of what was getting at there. I have my sort of thing that I was saving as the major problem I had with what he said, even though I have to agree with a lot of it. But, Kevin, I'm interested to get your impressions from the majority there that we were able to get to.
I found his message a little confused, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm not sure which side he was coming down on. And when he comes out and says we're buying acai I don't even know what that is, but it's fraud. When you come out and say something like that, you just lose credibility. I think he was talking about acai berry, which you could mispronounce as acai if truly you didn't know what it was, like he said. His point just simply isn't nuanced enough. When he talks about genetically modified food, yes, we have been tinkering with nature through husbandry and agriculture for thousands of years. But that's not the same as trans-species genetic modification, where we're talking about creating entirely new species that have new genotypes in them and where we're taking genes from one species and implanting them in another, where we have no idea how that gene will express itself in a new organism and a new environment and what the repercussions are. And you don't have to I mean, the examples of disaster from releasing invasive species into ecosystems are just, you know, are all over the planet. You know, Australia's ecosystems have been devastated by invasive species. The Great Lakes here in Canada, you know, have something like 300 invasive species in them, and those ecosystems are being destroyed. And that's the game we're playing with some of these genetically modified organisms. Like putting vitamin A in rice is not the same as making Roundup Ready corn, which has been proven. It's an undeniable fact. If he wants to talk about science, well, it's been you know Darwin was right, and natural selection takes place. And if you make a plant immune to your particular pesticide, so that you can spray more of that pesticide and kill everything but the plant, all you do is you develop weeds that are resistant as well. And that's what's happening. There's a scourge of weeds that are now resistant to Roundup, and they've been created by Monsanto, and it's Roundup Ready corn.
No, exactly. And you nailed exactly what I was hoping, the exact part that I was hoping you nailed from that, which was he was saying, well, there's sort of two parts, but one of them was that he's like, you know, it's not, you know, science isn't a company. I'm glad we at least got as far as that part, because that was really the thing that sort of upset me, was that he's like, well, science isn't a company. You know, we should be upset about laws and policy, not science. It was like, okay, well, outside of the few folks that he was sort of referencing that, you know, don't believe in climate change or vaccines or GM, then those people, I could see you maybe taking the position that they are simply dismissing anything that seems scientific. But I really don't think that's the majority of people that have a problem with GM foods. And I think it was a very, what's the logical fallacy I'm looking for? It was, I think it was a straw man to,
yeah.
I try and correlate anti-vaxxers to people who have a problem with GM because of the reasons you outlined. I mean, one of the other major ones is, yes, we've been, say, you know, the banana. There was that famous thing about the banana. But, you know, about how if you've ever seen a picture of what an actual wild original banana looks like, it looks closer to like a sort of a pineapple than anything else. Hard shell, dark color. We've done it all. Dogs, all sorts of stuff. But here's the thing. All of those things were changed within the environments that they were being used in. These are taking things out of the environment, messing with them and dropping them back in. And it's really critical. The critical difference is, it may not seem like that's a big difference, but the critical difference is when you adjust things in nature, like you leave it in nature while you're adjusting it, like breeding dogs are still, you're not, you know, sort of cutting up cells, but you're next generation, and you go a little bit more this way, a little bit more that way, is that the environment itself sort of compensates as you go. Right? Or if there's a major problem, like, oh, this is going to be bad because this new dog that you just bred is wiping out, you figure that out. Like, there are indications before it because you're doing it step by step, right? When you're going through evolutional generations, that's a minor difference and a more minor difference. And so you can sort of catch things. Whereas this is sort of like leapfrogging to the end result and like crossing your fingers and hoping it doesn't blow up in your face. That, I think it was an absolutely ridiculous comparison to make.
Well, his argument, like I said, just simply wasn't nuanced enough. Like there's, you know, David Suzuki is opposed to genetically modified organisms, and he's a respected geneticist, you know, whose textbook is still required reading in first year genetics courses. Mm-hmm. And the process of genetic modification, like I said, putting vitamin A in rice is probably a great idea. But taking genes out of fish and taking genes out of insects and splicing them into agricultural products is just a game of roulette. We do not know how those genes will express themselves in new organisms and new environments, because a gene, you know, you could have the disposition for diabetes, but you'll never know that unless you eat too much sugar. You'll just never know that. So we're introducing things, and we're going to say we don't know what environmental triggers might set them off and turn them into things we don't want, as opposed to hope for the beneficial effects that we're hoping for.
Mm-hmm. And the other major problem I had with that, just before we go to a brief break here again, was that I guess it's harping on the same point, but I just really really wanted to emphasize it that like. When you're talking about changing things, he was saying you can choose to disagree with things, but you can't disagree with facts, or you can't make up your own facts.
Right.
Well, you know, he's sort of making up his own facts because like
well,
in
he
that
was cherry picking them
because well a, yeah he was cherry picking them, but also the case that like okay if yeah science isn't a company, but it's the companies that are doing science. And so, yeah, I don't have a problem with science. I love science. I have a freaking Carl Sagan tattoo on my arm. Okay, I'm a huge science guy. I love it. But it's the product, right? It's what you're doing with it. I'm not anti-science, but I am anti the company that's in charge of science, and I am anti the policy. So he's like, well, don't get upset at science. Get upset at policy. He's like, well, you're not listening. It is the policy that we're upset with. You're making a false correlation to science in general.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And that was the major problem I had was, hey, you know, there's a lot of really, really legitimate, and I don't mean myself, there's a lot of really legitimate, really intentionally smart people who are very informed, like David Suzuki, who really know what they're talking about, who are saying, hey, these are bad ideas, and here's why. And these are really bad ideas because it's scary and new, and I don't like new things. It's, and here's why. And there's a really long, freaking long argument with many, many different points on it as to why these are terrible ideas. Now, I think we should still have a discussion about it. But as someone that in general, I would probably agree with, I found this to be a really useless talk. And yeah. I kind of wanted to play it because in general, he'd be someone that I think normally we might be able to play something by and be in total agreement with. And I'm total agreement with him with part of his talk, but I think he just completely missed the boat on this one.
And actually, it just occurred to me that I hope he's talking about putting beta carotene in rice and not actually vitamin A, because vitamin A is toxic. if you exceed the recommended level, vitamin A is toxic, but beta carotene isn't. Beta carotene is what your body produces vitamin A out of. So you can take in as much beta carotene as you want, and your body will produce as much vitamin A as you need. But if you were to just be putting vitamin A in some food product, you'd be putting a limit on how much rice someone could eat.
Yeah. Well, don't make up your own facts, Kevin. You can't make up your own facts. Anyway, we're going to leave that as it is. We're going to come back. Hopefully, we're going to have time to sneak in the story of stuff here. But first, we're going to go to a quick update by Leah Massolini.
Thanks, Darren. In Canadian news this week, Environment Canada set itself a warning after a diesel leak at a water research building. The federal government also hit suspected polluters with warnings instead of prosecutions. Environment Canada says extreme weather could be the new normal. Gas production is uncertain after the Deep Panuke fire off the coast of Nova Scotia. And in international news, a new study reports that the Andean glaciers are melting at unprecedented rates. Also, 140 countries agreed to a mercury treaty at the UN talks in Geneva. UK scientists bid to mimic plant energy creation to produce more renewable fuel. And there's some serious controversy surrounding Whole Foods CEO saying that climate change is not necessarily bad. All these stories and more on Twitter at Green Majority. Also, check out our Facebook page and like us to follow more stories. Also, I would like to make a star mention to CJUM, a community radio station out of the University of Manitoba. They are a new syndicate of our show, and we'd like to say a big thanks to them and all the folks out there. And lastly, some of the Green Majority staff will be attending the Canadian Auto Show on Thursday, February 14th, and we'll be speaking with some important people regarding car industry and the future of the car industry through an environmental lens.
Yeah, if people were listening last year, Ari and I had a hell of a lot of fun at the auto show, and it took us a little while to put all the feedback back together, but I think we ended up with a really fun show after that. So I'm really excited about going to the auto show, even though I kind of feel like I'm, the sheep in wolf's clothing sneaking among all the cars there. But we did have a good fun, so I am looking forward to that. Thank you very much, Leah Massolini. We're going to take a quick music break, and then we'll be back to wrap up the program. We got a couple more stories we're going to get to. I think I may have to save the story of cosmetics for another day, but it's very, very relevant to today's show, so don't wait until I play it on the show. You should go on YouTube, the story of cosmetics. But we'll be right back to wrap up the show right after this music break.
Option. second fiddle's not my name. I'm gonna move a locomotive. Passengers who never stop. I fill my train car with foolish notions. And brimming full with other sharks for me. I'll spill my blood for the cold reaction. And watch them closely as they come to feed. Thought I was a decent swimmer, but maybe I don't need to swim. Hiding in the darkest waters.
All right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I want to thank once again DJ Amber Waves over at Open Till Midnight blog for producing all the music. I'm not making fun of her, but I would like to mention that she actually did almost forget to send me the show, which would sound like I was teasing her, except that I was actually using this as an opportunity to actually say how awesome she is, because even though she forgot to send us music this week, she got my email at like 11 o'clock and I think woke up at like 6 a.m. to get this stuff to us. So even though you forgot, you still managed to prove that you're even more awesome than I thought. Thank you very much, Amber, for sending it, for getting us that. There's always good music every week provided by Amber Waves. We list all the tracks and her short reviews of each of the tracks and links to all the artists, which commonly, because it's all Canadian content that we play on the show, and a lot of them are indie bands that can frequently be downloaded for free. So definitely, if you like any of the music, go and check it out. You may be able to get the songs, or at least find out where you can get it as well. Kevin, we're going to deal with a couple more stories here. We're almost out of time. But I just wanted to talk about one of the other ones that definitely jumped to my attention, which was just reports from China about record-setting pollution levels. We already heard during the Olympics when it was in China that they had to shut down like vast areas of the city for months in advance just to be able to have people sort of be able to breathe during the Olympics. Now all these factories are back up and running at this point, obviously. And they're still considering rolling blackouts of factories and stuff like that, because since 2008, they've only been measuring I don't have the actual number in front of me, but it was something to the order of like an order of magnitude, like 10 times over what the safe limits were, or potentially even in excess. What did you gather from the article?
Well, the scale of the impacts of human activity are very hard to imagine for most people. We still think of ourselves as just one person, and we see the impacts of our own lives on the environment around us. We see how much garbage we throw out. We see how much energy we consume. And, you know, we just literally can't wrap our heads around some things, like say the tar sands, where even from a helicopter, it looks like you're hovering over the surface of the moon, because so much of the landscape is just missing for miles and miles in every direction. Like to see it, you can't wrap your head around it. That's basically the story of pollution in China. You can't wrap your head around it. They are producing vast, unimaginable amounts of pollution in their blinding headlong rush to industrialization. And, you know, I've mentioned on this show before that I took a course here at U of T where we ran simulations on the industrialization of China and projected the burden of pollution. And it was a tidal wave. Even, you know, forget climate change. China could simply pollute the world into its next environmental crisis. You know, in Beijing, the air quality was being measured in the 700s, where 25 was considered the safe limit by their indexing system.
Oh, yeah, actually, I'm sorry. That was actually the number I was referring to. You said the 25 is a safe index. They'd had reports as high as 500 before, and I believe the most recent one was 776.
Was in the high 700s.
Yeah, so yeah. Even more than an order of magnitude. That's like 30 times higher.
Well, so it made the news because air currents were trapping it against a mountain range, and it was smogging out Beijing, and so it became noteworthy. But you know, when the air is blowing in another direction, that pollution is just being dispersed somewhere else, and China is a huge country. It has a lot of people. It is being fueled by dirty, dirty, dirty coal. And it's industrializing at just a breathtaking pace. Like, it's just one of those things, as an individual, you know, living your own life, we are the dominant species on this planet now. And collectively, the burden of the impacts of human activity are just titanic. And so it made the news because it was hard to breathe in Beijing, and they sold out of air respiratory masks, and the hospital wards were full of people who couldn't breathe. But it's still, there's, you know, even when the winds are blowing another direction, that's still happening. It's just not making the news. It's like,
the only difference is whether or not the stores have run out of stock.
Exactly.
That's why it didn't make the headlines. It was because they had enough.
They're still producing that much pollution every single day, and it's going somewhere. And there's, I mean, ultimately the atmosphere is a finite resource. We will fill it up.
Yeah, it's, I mean, one of the things if you check the website afterwards, we'll post a link to all these stories. There's actually a video near the bottom by a gentleman in Beijing who's either done or is in the process of doing, I couldn't read the Chinese, unfortunately, but doing a documentary on the smog just in Beijing. And even from that, like, 3-minute clip, you get some of the idea. Like, it kind of looks like when it's sort of getting dark, what are used to here, kind of dusk when it's snowing, and it's kind of, you know, there's that hour where everybody looks beautiful, and then right after that everything starts to look gray during a snowstorm. That's what it looked like. It looked like a freaking snowstorm, and it's black soot in the air. Like, I thought I was looking at the normal news report of traffic for, like, Toronto during, like, December, and it's like just the air in Beijing during the middle of the day. It's shocking. As you said, like, you can't even wrap your head around it.
It like I said, China's producing unimagined, and it's not just the air, it's the water. There's a catalog of rivers in China that are classified as unsafe to touch, let alone drink from. You're not even supposed to come in physical contact with the water, and that's just pouring out to the sea. It's the solution to pollution is dilution adage. And it's just another thing we need to worry about.
All right. So I was just looking at my clock to see how much time we have left, and I'm actually a couple minutes over already. I do apologize to Tally and Nubian coming up next. That is all the time we have for you. You've been listening to The Green Majority. I'm Darren Kaster. Kevin Farmer as well. Leah's jumping around in the studio as well, doing a lot of behind-the-scenes production. Thank you very much for listening. Check the website for any more information. And other than that, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks so much.